Hello, welcome to the Behind the Headlines podcast with me, John Crowley.
And me, Hannah Storm. In our podcast, we speak with colleagues from across our journalism industry about the stories they've covered and their own stories as well. We hear from them about how our industry is adapting to the realisation that it needs to take discussions around mental health more seriously and how journalism can shape and normalise conversations around well-being.
Hannah and I are both directors of Headlines Network and have been involved in journalism for decades. We know that journalists aren't robots. They face pressures either because of the stories they cover or the situations they find themselves in wherever they work.
For this episode, we're hosting a special conversation between two colleagues, Victoria McDonald, Health and Social Care Editor for Channel 4 News, and Emily Morgan, the Health Editor for ITV News. Hi, Emily and Victoria. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Hello.
You've both been on the front line of COVID, one of the biggest news stories in our lifetimes. Quite simply, what was it like for you both?
Covering the pandemic was the most difficult, fascinating, bizarre and horrific story I've probably ever covered. I don't know how better to describe it than that. It was like nothing I've ever done before. There were so many facets of it. It wasn't just one story. It was hundreds of stories within one story. And it not only took over my professional life, but it took over my personal life too. So it wasn't one of those stories that you could just walk away from at the end of the day and start afresh the next day. It permeated everything we did for months and months. And it was one of the only stories I've worked on where we didn't really know what we were doing or what we were talking about. And I can speak not only from my own perspective as a journalist, but I think also from a scientific perspective. As a journalist, we were sitting and listening to scientists who were also scrabbling around in the dark, which made our reporting very, very difficult. So it was probably the most challenging thing I have ever worked on.
And Victoria?
Yes, I would agree. It's funny looking at it now as I'm more at the end of my career, in a way that as I get towards, you know, looking back on the decades of health reporting, I said to myself that everything I'd reported over those decades had brought me to this place. In a way, the HIV pandemic, although I call it a pandemic, it never was declared one. All those big health stories that I'd covered over the years, but actually nothing did prepare me for it, except to understand that viruses don't behave how you expect them to behave. But as Emily said, you lived and breathed it, and you would come home at night and you would fall into bed in sheer exhaustion and you would dream it. Then you would wake up the next morning and you would start all over again. It took a lot to prepare because you were never quite sure what the day would hold. You might start the day with one story and then something bigger would break halfway through, or you would just finish editing a piece, in our case, at 6:30, you'd be pressing the send button, as it were, and then another breaking story would happen, so you'd have 10 minutes to prepare to get into the studio. And I do remember once sitting in the studio saying, we are being bombarded with so much data, I can't actually tell you what this data means. And that was quite a risky thing to say live on air, but I think people appreciated it at the time, where we were all often in the dark about what this meant. And sometimes that data, which looked pretty robust at the time, turned out not to be robust. So you were constantly catching up, learning. Again, as Emily said, it was absolutely fascinating. And it was one of the first times where, because you were all scientists, government, you were all on a steep learning curve, you felt you could ring people up and say, please help me, I don't understand what this means. And it was gratifying in a way. And I think I've made some of the best contacts ever out of this. But it's funny looking back now, you know, more than 2 years later, thinking, oh my goodness, what a ride.
If I could just pick up on what you said, Victoria, I think it was really refreshing. And I wouldn't ever normally admit this or say this, because I always like to go in the studio knowing what I'm talking about. But there was something really refreshing about going in and saying, I'm not actually sure. You know, this is what I've been told. This is what we're being presented with. We don't know. There was something really refreshing about that, because it was like we were talking so directly to our viewers because they also didn't know. We were all in it together. And that, for a journalist, is very unique, because usually we are the knowledgeable ones. We know the facts and we are imparting those facts. And that was something quite special about this. We were all learning together.
I'm really struck by what you were both saying before about how you kind of lived and breathed this story. Within my career, I spent a lot of time working with journalists in hostile environments, journalists who live and breathe the story of disaster and conflict, of physical threat, of mental unease as well. And it strikes me this is one of the first stories, for us in the UK at least, I think, that we've lived and breathed so continuously. So how did you navigate the ways in which the kind of professional world blurred with your personal world as well?
Unlike Emily, I've only got one child to deal with. So I was very grateful for that, and that she was a bit older, although she did need homeschooling, which I just laughed hilariously at when the school said that they expected me to supervise some of that. One of the first things I did very early on was I went to Gary Gibbon, our political editor, and to Lindsay Hilsum, our international editor, and said, how do you do it? How do you sustain this pressure? How do you keep going day after day? I mean, poor Gary, he had to deal with Brexit. at least this was, you know, endlessly interesting. But it was about maintaining your energy levels. Unlike the rest of the nation, I virtually stopped drinking because I couldn't even have one glass of wine and then get up the next day and function. Lockdown was actually a blessing in disguise, really, because you didn't have to make decisions about the rest of your life. I was very lucky that my daughter's father was able to take up most of the childcare. But I was very conscious at weekends that I needed to give her some attention. It's that tension that a working mother has. But I was quite early on very, very aware that I needed to preserve my energies and my mental health as well, to make sure I didn't burn out.
It's interesting there that you said that you spoke to Lindsay Hilsum, who's got huge experience covering international conflicts, and we spoke to Lindsay here on a previous podcast. Did it feel in some ways like you were covering a war with thousands of people dying each week?
It certainly did for me. I mean, it's difficult as a health journalist to say that, but it was certainly a war, and it felt like the battlefield had come to sort of suburban hospitals. I think in the sense, the way, as Victoria said, we had to reserve our energy and ensure that we were constantly assessing our mental well-being and checking in on ourselves and making sure that we had the energy or ability to continue doing what we were doing. That was really very important. And we didn't have flak jackets, but of course we had PPE, and that became our armour, if you like, in the hospitals. In the same way that a conflict, you go in and you don't know what to expect. You don't know what is around the corner. I think that was the same as us. I don't know if you'll agree, Victoria, but the first time I went into a hospital, I had to have a conversation with my family. It was a, okay, they've asked me to do this. We have to do it. We need to do this. I mean, there was no question about that. But should it be me? And at this time, we didn't know very much about COVID and what it did. My husband is in his 50s. I had to have conversations about whether he was prepared for me to take that risk and bring anything home, you know, potentially any infection home. I've got children. I had to think about them. So though all those sort of initial decisions about whether to go in or not had to be made. And then, of course, once we were there, it was a hostile environment. You know, we were in a hospital that was potentially incredibly infectious. And so everything we did, from working together as a team with my producer and the camera operator, to putting out very, very long pieces with distressing images, everything we did was tantamount, I think, to being in a war zone.
Yeah, I was actually just having a discussion with the junior doctor recently, who didn't like the terminology, the war terminology, but I've never thought of a different way of putting it, because even if you were fighting for people's lives, we weren't obviously, but the staff were fighting for people's lives, they were battling fatigue. It felt like that was the best terminology to use. I'd done the Ebola training. I never actually went and did the story in the end, much to my disappointment. But actually that helped enormously because it had already given me some training in sort of risk assessment. And the hospitals that we were going into were really amazing at helping us navigate our way through it. And people always said, weren't you scared? And I said, actually, not really, because you felt safer on an intensive care ward, completely covered from head to toe in PPE. And I said that the most dangerous part of it was getting there on the tube or having a coffee afterwards where you would let your guard down. Those were the bits where I thought, this is where I'm going to get it. As it happened, I didn't get COVID until last week. Which is why I probably still sound blocked up. But we were very well looked after almost everywhere we went.
I guess there's a slight difference. I mean, I was thinking when you were both talking there about war zone and conflict, I think that sometimes there were rules around war. The history of war shows us that war kind of works in a certain way, but this was completely unprecedented, right? You can't see where the threats are coming from in many ways. You can't feel it. You've got no kind of baseline on which to measure past experience. And so the uncertainty is so extreme, and yet you don't really know how to protect yourself other than trying to learn on the job, sort of, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I would totally agree with that. It was an enemy we couldn't see. We had absolutely no idea where it was coming from. And I think there is a certain amount of preparation you can obviously do before you go into a hostile environment, like a conflict on the ground. But I think this one felt very different because there was no history. There was no context. We had nothing to measure it against whatsoever. It was like it was completely untrodden ground. And we didn't know what to expect day to day. And despite those images that came from Italy right at the beginning, I don't think any of us really knew what to expect when we got into the hospital. But as Victoria said, it was the complete calm and measured guidance from the doctors and consultants and people in the hospital that really got me through. I mean, I don't think I would have been able to have done it without them. But I think that the unknown and the fear of where this enemy was and how it might have got to us or infected us, I think that was the worst thing for me. At least in a conflict, you pretty much almost always know where your enemy is, but this was very, very different.
It's fair to say that health reporting was certainly on the front line during the pandemic. Do you think now, looking back down through the tunnel, is there a better understanding and appreciation of health reporting in general? But also, is it fair to say that health reporting has now become more politicised, particularly around the wearing of masks or maintaining lockdowns?
Yes to the first and slightly no to the second. The entire nation now knows what epidemiology means. And I thought that was a word just for me. And the number of times my friends would earnestly tell me about the latest scientific findings, and I think, well, yes, I did read that myself. But, you know, I was pleased because it started a whole national conversation about looking after yourself a bit better and something I hope that sustains. Politicised health has always been political. Always, completely and utterly. That hasn't changed at all. And sure, there were debates over whether masks were good or were useful or not, or whether COVID existed or not. Then came along the vaccines. But it's always been thus. I think more than ever, it showed the tensions, I suppose, which have never been to the fore, between the government and the scientists, and the fact that you got independent SAGE setting up very quickly because they wanted to give an alternative and very valuable voice to what we were hearing from the official SAGE, and those Downing Street briefings where you weren't quite sure whether you were being told something because it was politically expedient or because it really did have scientific value. And this is not to traduce in any way the scientists and the doctors who were standing up there beside the Prime Minister, because I think they did a very good job actually under those circumstances. But I would say it became slightly more political, but it has always been there, always. My entire career as a health journalist has involved talking to government at the same time as talking to doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals.
Emily, your background is in, you know, a number of different beats, but you have been a political reporter. What's your thoughts on the politicisation of health reporting?
In many ways, I agree with what Victoria said. I don't think it's the health reporting that became more politicised. It was certainly the subject matter that became politicised. And I think during the pandemic, that was just heightened to such a degree. Victoria may disagree, but health universally is generally something people agree on. And it became something that we were all beginning to disagree on or fight over or have different views on. And although that is probably no different to any other health stories, it was so heightened that as a nation, I sort of feel that we would, in dealing with the pandemic, it really polarised different political parties. So it polarised the right and the left. And you mentioned wearing masks. But, you know, those things like lockdowns, like masks, how to deal with a pandemic or this sort of major health crisis that we were going through became a debate on either side of the House of Commons, which was difficult to report on, really, because we were not political reporters. We are not political reporters. What we had to do was try and zone out the sort of, at least what I tried to do, was zone out the political noise and try and focus and navigate through the science as best we could, which was very difficult because, of course, the science that was being presented was being interpreted by the government. And then we had to try, as health reporters ourselves, interpret that science ourselves and then ask the right questions about whether that was being interpreted in the right way or not. So, yeah, it was a very, very difficult time. There was a real fine line. And trying to, I suppose, hear the voices from all quarters and then present what we thought was the right science and then let others make up their view about whether the government was making the right decisions around that science or not. It was very tricky.
And yet at the same time, we saw this infodemic, the sense that actually almost every bit of information that was out there was often being kind of used and interpreted and sometimes disinformation, misinformation abounding. And so that must have been really difficult to figure out the news, as it were, from all of this noise. Were you yourselves targeted? Did you have to deal with any kind of online harassment? Because we know that female journalists particularly, and we know the Health Beat particularly, are targets for this.
I wasn't targeted online. I think my reports were always questioned on Twitter. I wouldn't call it harassment. I was called names. I was called a government stooge. I was criticised for peddling certain views about lockdown, whether I was anti-lockdown or for lockdown. We were told we were spreading fake news, that COVID didn't exist. I mean, there was all, you know, all those things that were going online began to be targeted at us because, of course, we were the reporters. So, yeah, that was very difficult. I think, again, for ITV News, there was a very sort of difficult balance between countering disinformation really, really carefully, but then equally giving it too much credence by even addressing it. So I think from my point of view, the propaganda around the vaccine was a very sort of difficult thing to report on. I mean, Victoria might disagree. Channel 4 News probably took a different view to these sorts of things, but we had to be very careful about what sort of disinformation we reported without giving it too much credit, as it were. And Victoria, you probably got a different view on this.
Well, it was very difficult, but I think I just kept telling myself we're a public service broadcaster and that has to override everything. So in some ways it made you very cautious about trying to get everything as absolutely right as possible so that when the anti-vaxxers or the COVID doesn't exist people came back at you, you had a robust armoury against them. But I have to say, I zoned a lot of it out.
Yeah.
I was quite confident in the scientists that we were getting our information from. We had the most excellent support from the Science Media Centre. We got briefings sometimes two or three times a day, and you had access to those scientists. So if you were in any doubt, not that I ever was in any doubt about the vaccines or that COVID existed, but, you know, if there were any little niggly concerns, like masks, you know, the value of masks, who it was protecting, etc. You know, there were people you could go to. So I relied very much on decades of health reporting experience and my instincts in many respects, and then absolutely fantastic experts to help you. The building, of course, did get invaded several times by anti-vaxxers, and both times I wasn't here, so I didn't take that personally either. But I think they were targeting Jon Snow at the time, for goodness knows what reason.
I think I was very conscious about also putting other people in the firing line. There was one instance in a hospital, it was Preston Hospital, where I had interviewed a young man. He was a very young man. He was in his 20s. He had been incredibly sick, been in intensive care for days. He had just come out and was on a COVID ward, but was still very ill, and consultants were still very concerned about him. He hadn't been vaccinated. And he can only have been 21 or 22. And he regretted not being vaccinated. The reason I'm telling this story is because after I interviewed him, he was then targeted on Twitter, and his family was targeted on Twitter. He was called a liar. They were giving him death threats. They even found an actor's photo that looked like him and said that he was an actor. I mean, they were going to any lengths to try and discredit his story. And they thought that the government had put him up for us specifically. So I felt then that we had to be very careful in who we were putting in the firing line, as it were, because, of course, as independent journalists, we do not work with the government and allow the government to put actors on beds to try and promote a vaccine that, as they say, doesn't work or cause deaths. But, of course, I needed to be very conscious about who we were interviewing and whether they then, after the interview, were perhaps, you know, mentally well enough to be able to deal with that sort of backlash.
Actually, I was standing outside Milton Keynes Hospital once when a couple drove by in their car. I'd just come off the COVID ward and had been very sad. A woman had given birth to twins while she was in intensive care in a coma, and she was actually only meeting those twins for the first time when we were there. And we came out to do the live, and this couple said, oh, you know, it's all fake, the hospital's completely empty, which was not true. And then they said, oh, and all the beds are full of actors. So it was like, well, it's either empty or it's not. And they were shouting this out as I was going live. And I just thought, you can't deal with that sort of misinformation. You just have to try and ignore it, because you could argue back, but what would be the point?
You were saying you can't deal with that. I wonder, I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well, I mean, there is no point in some ways arguing back in those circumstances, because they're not going to listen to you. There's some fascinating research being done around things like vaccine hesitancy and about whether you're asking the right question in the first place, so that people aren't actually necessarily anti-vaxxer, they just want more information. And that I'm really happy to engage with and try and give them the information that I have or steer them in the right direction. But if people are going to say a hospital is full of actors, I mean, what can you say? It's not even worth arguing about. The only times I got really upset, I think when it was friends, people I knew who started spouting misinformation. And I don't think I had the bandwidth to deal with that. So I would get very upset if somebody started talking to me about how the vaccines caused infertility or something. And I just think, all right, well, I will just have to leave them to it. They're intelligent people. They can go and find out their information. And I think that was a self-preservation thing.
I absolutely agree with you there, Victoria. I just, for me, that was exactly the same. I could not engage. I didn't have the bandwidth to engage in that sort of thing. It was a fragile time anyway, those 2 years, particularly in my professional life. So I just had to zone it out and not even go there.
Just moving beyond COVID, the wider topics that you cover that involve life and death situations, of course, as well, both uplifting and depressing. Many of the people that you speak to might be vulnerable, living with an illness, or have lost family members, and might not always be open to speaking. Particularly in health reporting, that demands a lot of empathy and resilience on your part too. How do you ensure that the relationship between you and your contributors then doesn't become transactional, if you like?
It definitely is transactional. There's no doubt about that. You need them to talk to the camera. It was very different from when I was reporting in newspapers, because it was sometimes easier for them not having to appear on camera. But I go to great lengths, and particularly sensitive stories, to say you don't have to do this. It might do some good if you do, because people want to hear your story, but that we will stop the camera if you can't cope anymore. Part of it is informed by mental health reporting. So we have very strict guidelines around mental health reporting, and I tend to use some of those same rules, as it were, a lot around that. So for mental health reporting, I will say you have the right up until broadcast to pull this interview. So you are in control. Now, at the back of your mind, in all honesty, you're thinking, please don't do that, because that's really going to cause me a lot of problems. And I will talk through, in particularly sensitive areas, the value of telling your story. But and the final outcome is that I need that story for my television broadcast. So you are hoping in the best possible way that they will do that broadcast.
I think a lot of the time, it sort of depends how we find these people. A lot of the time, the people we speak to want to speak. And for some, I'm not talking, you know, about everybody, but for some people, speaking about what they've been through or what they're going through, telling their story, for them is a process which is a positive process. Not only do they think that it might help others, but it is sometimes, you know, I've been told it's cathartic for them too. And so not only are they providing us with a story that we can then tell everybody and perhaps help other people, but it is something that may well help them too. And for me, as a journalist, that's really important, because it isn't just about me. We do not tell these stories for our own profile or publicity. It is essentially for them. And as Victoria says, they don't have to do it. They can stop whenever they want. And as Victoria says, we make that very, very, very clear to them. And I think in all my time as a reporter, there has never been an instance where someone has regretted it or been immensely upset or asked for the broadcast to be pulled, which I suppose is incredible.
We've talked there about sharing other people's stories and kind of navigating that relationship with the contributors. Both of you are relatively private human beings in terms of your profile on social media and elsewhere. But Victoria, you've spoken about your own story of having your child. And I just wondered, it's been a long time ago now, but how was it for you to become the story, as it were, rather than just telling other people's stories? And I don't mean just in a derogatory way at all.
Well, I thought very long and hard about writing about having fertility treatment, and, well, it was more than having fertility treatment. I mean, it was having egg donation. But it was partly, I felt all right about doing it because I knew that I was always going to talk to my daughter about how she had come about, but also because there was a bit of a backlash against egg donation, and I wanted to counter some of the misinformation that was out there. And really the best way of doing it was to talk about the shared joy of finally being able to have a child after 5 failed attempts and thinking I was never going to be a mother. So it was actually, well, it's that word again, it was, for me, it was cathartic to write about it. But it was also to put some of the information out there and maybe in a more human context to say, if this is what I went through, this is what you might go through, these are the questions you'll ask yourself. These are the questions I'm still asking myself. I mean, I wouldn't do it about many things, but just occasionally, sometimes you think you can add value yourself because you've been through it. I mean, I wrote an article a few years ago about the death of my stepmother and saying, you know, not all stepmothers are terrible. You know, there are some really wonderful stepmothers out there, and to celebrate that, you know. So it's if something crops up, I don't mind. I don't actually think of myself as an incredibly private person. Actually, I think there's something about appearing on screen that takes away some of that privacy. Maybe I think that most of my life isn't that interesting enough to talk about it. Otherwise, I go to work, I go home.
Emily, is there anything you'd like to add there to privacy aspect?
I suppose I'm not a publicity seeker, and I don't do my job for the profile that it gives me or the publicity it gives me. If I had something that I wanted to add, like Victoria has done, then I probably wouldn't think twice about doing it. But I do feel quite strongly that my personal life is my personal life. I am on television, but what I do professionally doesn't mean that what I do privately is a sort of access all areas. I'm extremely fortunate to have a wonderful family who I absolutely love and admire, and as much as I love my job, my family always, or at least most of the time, comes first. And there are moments where work and family life obviously collide. There are, you know, have been some very difficult moments, I think, particularly in the last couple of years. I have obviously a few regrets, like missing birthdays or, you know, missing certain things, not spending enough time with my children who are only ever going to be young once. But I try really hard to redress those moments quite quickly and to change it. But I think the boundary between my work and my private life is there for a reason. And the reason is that I need to keep it private so that I can completely switch off and be private, be a wife and a mother when I'm at home. And that boundary is really, really, really important to me. And it's the reason, I think, probably that I remain grounded and sane most of the time.
It's so powerful to hear you say that. With all the folks we've spoken with for the podcast, we ask, what advice would they give others in terms of managing their mental health? And a lot of the time, the issue of boundaries comes up. A lot of the time, the issue of connection and being kind of rooted within your community or your family or friends comes up as well. So it strikes me that that is kind of, it's such a powerful thing to hear you say that. I think it'd be nice to hear from both of you if you have other advice or tips for the listeners or for our journalism community around what has helped you manage your mental health.
I've always said that to be an effective health reporter, you do need to put up a slight barrier between you and the story, which isn't to say that you're not feeling incredible empathy. I remember one story where I was just weeping and weeping and turned around to find the cameraman was weeping and weeping as well, and the poor couple who'd lost their baby were handing us the tissues. But mostly you have to be able to slightly step back and go home to your own child, to your family, and sort of slightly park us, even if it's at the back of your mind. COVID didn't allow you that respite, so it was harder to park. So you were coming back with the images of what you'd seen in the intensive care ward really firmly still in the front of your mind and trying to push that back so you could concentrate on your child or doing the housework or, you know, all the mundane type things that I found very difficult. So if we had February, March, April, May, went through those waves, got to September and it was really quiet and I was in a terrible place. I felt really awful because I thought the biggest story of my life, even though I knew this wasn't true, I thought the biggest story of my life is over and done with. People were saying, oh, well, you know, you've had your dash, you know, you're not going to be the lead story from now on. And I went and had some counselling because I'd sort of anticipated this was going to happen, that it had been so exciting, so fascinating, and then suddenly there was this quiet. So I had about 6 weeks of counselling, and then, of course, the next wave came, and then it was all for nothing. So what I did was I almost booked in some counselling for the next time, for when I could next anticipate it was going to be quiet. And I've had two lots of counselling now. Just to talk through things that I felt like I couldn't talk about with my friends or my family. I mean, sometimes Emily and I will bump into each other getting our lunch and we'll stand there talking about how we're feeling about life on the front line now or whatever, because there are few who can understand, as with war correspondents, what you went through and how difficult it is to come down. I mean, it is no coincidence that particularly, maybe not quite so much now, but that journalists can quite often turn into alcoholics because you're desperate to find a way to stop that adrenaline running. And that was a constant almost. It was going in the same waves that COVID was going in. And that was how your emotional roller coaster was going as well.
And I guess it's only when you finally stop, well, you kind of crash sometimes, don't you? When you finally stop, the reality and the kind of just the intensity of everything hits you, I suppose.
And that was the moment for me, actually. It was, funnily enough, it was bumping into Victoria while we were getting our lunch, where we were talking about whether we, either of us, needed help or, you know, how we were sort of, you know, mentally with everything. And she mentioned about speaking to someone, and it hadn't crossed my mind. It hadn't even crossed my mind that perhaps I, of all people, needed to speak to someone about what we had been through. But it was something that got me thinking, and then I did end up going to, you know, speak to someone about it, and it was quite revelationary, actually, because it made me think through every emotion that we had had over the last 2 years, which I think as journalist, you very often, you just sort of keep putting things to the side. And you, as Victoria said, you have this barrier between you and the person or you and the story because you have to. You really have to do that. Otherwise, it's very, very difficult to kind of keep that impartiality. And so speaking through that helped me. And I think, Hannah, you mentioned it's only when you stop you realise that, you know, things aren't quite right. It was, for me, the moment was just before the Omicron wave hit, which was, I think, end of November time, 2021. We had had a bit of a lull in COVID. I'd begun to start looking at other stories. And I'd been very busy that week. I think it was a Thursday that this new variant was suddenly being talked about. And it just suddenly hit me. I was asked to do the top piece, Alive on the News at 10, which, you know, when you're doing news at 10 every night, it is relentless. It is relentless and it is tiring. And I think I just hit a wall at that point and I just thought, I can't do this. I really can't do it. And it wasn't just the sort of physical aspect of being in the studio at 10 o'clock that night. It was the mental aspect of knowing what was to come over the next 4 weeks, because I knew that this was looking bad. Scientists were already talking about this horrible new variant. And of course, we'd been there before. I felt like another wave, more, you know, visits to an ICU. I just felt like I couldn't do it. And the next day, I spoke to my editor and I said, I need help. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this. And at that point, I felt like the whole of ITN just came to my rescue and said, we are going to support you. We will do this. We can do this together. And I've never felt so immensely grateful for that in all my working career. And it was hard. I didn't particularly want to do it. I didn't enjoy those 4 weeks in the run-up to Christmas, but I felt utterly supported. And like I had a team behind me every single step of the way. And it was I think it was that moment of me holding my hand up and saying, I'm done. I can't do this. I just needed that help and support. And it got me through till January. And then January 2022, I took a break. I said, I just need some time. And that's when I went to see someone as like Victoria, and it just helped sort of recalibrate everything. It was probably one of the most important things I've done.
I think that's a really valuable thing to say, actually, because in journalism, you're not meant to ask for help. You're meant to just keep going, which is one of the problems with journalism in a way. And the glorious thing about television is that you do work with a team. And so that even if you don't go to your editor and ask for help, you turn to your producer, you turn to your camera, you turn to the people sitting next to you and go, I'm exhausted. And they do rally round and I was so grateful for my producers during COVID who just sustained me all the way, who could think when my brain had stopped working for me, you know. Sure, I was the person responsible for going into the studio or making sure the package, the film looked fine when it went out. But without that team around you, it couldn't have worked, actually, which is one of the better things in some ways than working for newspapers.
If I could just give one, I mean, you mentioned like perhaps giving someone a piece of advice. If I can give one piece of advice, it would be keep a tiny bit of your life that has absolutely nothing to do with the job, whether it's exercising or walking, spending time with your children, your husband, your family, your wife. Just reserve that one thing that makes you happy and never, ever, ever give it up.
Thank you, Emily. That's such an important piece of advice. Just back to Victoria's comment there about in journalism, we haven't been that great at asking for help. And I think this is one of the things that we're so committed to doing here. You know, we really want to try to promote more open conversations about mental health. It took me a hell of a long time when I had PTSD to ask for help, to share my story. I felt so ashamed. I was like, oh, it's never going to happen to me. Why should I need help? And I think that we're really grateful to both of you for tackling those taboos and those stigmas. John, you wanted to ask a question though.
Well, it's the final one, what we ask of all our interviewees, and perhaps it's a good question after everything that we've said, is why you think journalism matters. Why is it so important, particularly 2 years on from the, as you said, the most exciting but toughest story of your career?
It's very difficult, isn't it? But I've been thinking about it a lot because I've just turned 60, so there's probably not much longer to go, another couple of years or so. So I am looking back over a really fantastic career. I mean, journalism matters more than ever, and we can see that in not just in tackling misinformation and COVID. That was a really important role that we had. But even with what's happening now in America with Roe versus Wade, with all sorts of absolute crap that gets thrown at you through social media, through, we have to maintain that commitment to trying to, and I know it sounds pompous, but trying to get the truth out there, to trying to get people to think and to argue in a polite and democratic way in this moment where democracy feels forever under threat. That's us. Now, I've got somebody shadowing me at the moment, and I'm looking at her and I'm looking at the questions she's asking, and I'm thinking, this is really hopeful. This is the next generation of journalists coming up who will do just fine job, but don't let it be chipped away at. Don't let it become less than it is, because we are so important.
I completely agree. I think with the onset of social media and information, disinformation, misinformation online, I think truth has never been more important. And journalism matters because without first-hand impartial reporting, reporters on the ground telling people what is happening as it is happening, then we could lose truth. It has never been more important. And I believe that governments need to be held to account. I believe that reporters need to ask questions that viewers are not in such a privileged position to be able to do. And I just, in terms of what we have just seen over the last 2 years, that journalism mattered because we were being asked to believe what was happening. And we, as reporters, needed to see whether what the government was asking us to do was justified. And if that isn't a good enough example of why journalism matters, then I don't know what is.
Victoria and Emily, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
That was a really impactful conversation there. So many takeaways, but particularly the plea for why journalism matters at the end, Anna, that really resonated.
And I was really struck by how deeply they connected with each other, how they'd gained that support from each other in terms of being able to cope and manage their own mental health. And for me, that really does underscore the collegiate nature of many parts of journalism. And it's something that, you know, really important to remember, I think.
Please do remember to share our podcast with friends and colleagues on all the usual channels. We'll be back again soon.